Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast, created by Mark Shepherd and now run by me, Thomas Manuel. On today's show, we're talking to Sebastian Yue. Sebastian is a British-Chinese game designer based in Canada. And for someone who started in 2020, I think they're having this fantastic trajectory for their career. I think they're doing really cool work. And for anybody who wants to get into game design, I think Sebastian is a great person to look at and learn from. And I think they have a lot to say. And that's why we got this episode where we talk about lots of cool stuff about how they got started, what kind of work they do, what kind of games they make, and, you know, what kind of future trajectory they hope to have as a full-time game designer. And thanks once again to my patrons over at Patreon. Thank you so much for supporting the newsletter and this podcast. If you have suggestions, patron or not, about who I should talk to next on the podcast, who else I should have on to have a conversation with, please let me know. If you have a suggestion for a game in the Teaching Games series, let me know. Or if you have other ideas or feedback, feel free to write to me at notrueindian@outlook.com. With that said, let's get to the interview. All right, everyone. I'm sitting down with Sebastian Yue, a game designer, writer, and editor. Apart from their own self-published games and DM's Guild modules, they work full-time at Hit Point Press, which is probably best known for various very successful third-party D&D products like Hecna and Humblewood. They've also contributed as a designer to some really cool projects like Apocalypse Keys, Cloud Empress, the Ennie Award-winning Uncaged Goddesses anthology, and the currently in progress official Tomb Raider RPG. Also, you know, fun facts from their website that I have gleaned. Their favorite TV show is Batman, the animated series. And their favorite novel, which I also really adore, is Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. So hi, Sebastian. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I feel that Picture of Dorian Gray is one of those books that absolutely, like, changed my brain when I read it.
It changed my life, honestly. Yeah.
Nice.
It made me very obnoxious when I read it for the first time, but it really did change my life, and it changed the way that I thought about, you know, my relationship to art and aesthetics.
Yeah, yeah. Could you talk about that a little bit? It's affected me in very subtle ways, and I'm sure it affects you in a bunch of subtle ways, but, like, you know, what's the big thing that kind of stands out?
Honestly, I don't even know if this is supposed to be the message that you take away from this book necessarily, but it did introduce the idea to me that actually if you want to do something, then I don't necessarily have to justify it to anyone who isn't me. And, you know, that kind of makes me sound like a terrible person, but also, like, from a perspective of, I mean, you know, I'm a person of color who's also queer and trans, then I think that, like, you know, through that lens, that actually is very good, because at the time, I was very used to letting other people in my life dictate what I should and shouldn't want and whether or not my wants and desires should be prioritized. And I read Picture of Dorian Gray and I was like, okay, this white boy, he's terrible, but also he's having a lot of fun. So, like, that also could be me if I decided to care less. So that was kind of what I took away from it. I mean, what about you? Why do you like it?
Me on my journey into hedonism and
yeah, and exactly. Like, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, I looked at it and I was like, oh, okay. I mean, he really doesn't give a shit about anybody else around him, but also, like, look at him go. Like,
the thing that most affected me, I think, from that book is not even Dorian Gray as a character, but the person who introduces him to the whole thing. What's his name? Lord Henry Wotton.
Lord Henry Wotton. Yeah. Oh, I love that man. Yeah. He's so unserious, but he's also so correct. Yeah. Like, yeah. I really enjoy him. He's a great character. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. So my real first question is, how did you get into playing RPGs? And how soon did that transition into designing stuff for them?
It took a while, actually. The first RPG that I ever played was Pathfinder First Edition in 2014. Okay. I was not very good at it. I was playing a paladin. I didn't know what I was doing. I was that one person in combat who would have my character sheet out in front of me. And when it got to my turn, I'd be like, I don't know what I'm doing. I need to pause the game for a couple of seconds while I look through all my abilities. I also didn't really have a handle on the whole role-playing a character aspect of things. And I enjoyed it a lot, but I also just don't think that I had a good grasp of it. And it wasn't until 2020 that I actually decided to kind of sit down and become a game designer. I mean, I didn't even set out to become a game designer, but like in terms of timeline, that would be, I would say that I started in 2020 doing this professionally. And at that time, this also wasn't even a game design thing either, but like around that time, I was attending a support group for trans people with eating disorders, and we were taking turns to facilitate different sessions, and like we needed to find a different activity to do each week. And it was my turn, and I was like, well, I've really enjoyed playing D&D, because at that point I had a couple of home games running. And I thought, okay, I mean, I could write something up that they could play in maybe across 2 weeks. That would take up a couple of sessions. We could start with character creation. I can walk them through it. We can make like a level 3 party and then just go off and do that. And so I did do that, and I got like the reception that I got from it, from that group, most of whom had never played RPGs before, was very positive. And one of them asked, you know, what are you going to do with this now? Are you going to publish it? And I was like, first of all, is that a thing I could do? And second of all, how would I do that? And so I went home that day and I looked it up, and turns out that yes, that's a thing you can do. And I was like, okay, well, I guess my next step is to polish it up and publish that. And then I did that. And then after that, I just kind of kept doing it, and I kind of stumbled my way into becoming a game designer.
That is such a cool story. I wanna go back to two parts of it. The first part is, you know, I love the idea that when you started games, you described yourself as being bad at them. So my question is,
yeah, I was very bad, and honestly, I'm the kind of player that I would get annoyed with. Yeah.
So I wanna talk about, you know, why did you sort of like continue playing even though you were bad? Like, what was the thing that kept, you know, drawing you back to it? And secondly, I want to know a little bit about that first scenario you published. But yeah, let's do the first thing first. So what kept you coming back?
So actually, I played that game of Pathfinder, and I wasn't able to completely finish it because I was going on a trip and I'd be away for 5 weeks. And so I just had to tell the DM, you know what, I guess my character is going to go off and he's going to go on his own quest to find some relic. And then maybe it can just be an item that you make up for, you know, the party can get it at like before the final boss. He can come back and be like, here, I found you this relic. My job is done. Good luck against it. And so I did kind of have to exit that campaign. And then I didn't play again for several years. But then my partner at the time said that he was starting up a new game. And I was like, oh, I vaguely remember. And then, you know, it kind of, all of the memories of playing Pathfinder kind of came back to me. And I was like, wait, actually, maybe if I give this another go, I might be better at it. And I don't actually know what changed between then and when I took it up again. When I took it up again, I want to say that was maybe 2018-ish. So it had been like 4 years. I think, honestly, maybe it might have been having access to the rulebook, because for whatever reason, I did not buy the Pathfinder rulebook when I started playing it. I honestly don't remember why I did that. But for playing D&D, I did go off and get the rulebook, and there were also various places to look up the rules online, and it was a bit more accessible in that way. And so I could actually kind of learn the system better in a way that I couldn't before. I think that made a difference.
I imagine getting into Pathfinder first edition in 2014 is actually a complicated process, because you're like,
yeah, it was really complicated. There was a lot to remember. I did like it, and I also remember that I chose Paladin because I couldn't make up my mind. I didn't know what I liked at the time, and I went to the DM and I said, what character do I pick? There's a lot of options. And then he was like, well, I don't know, do you want to do magic, do you want to be strong and warrior? And I was like, yeah, but what if I wanted to do both? I want to make a character that's good at all of things. And he said, okay, well, sounds like a Paladin, you can do a bit of magic and you can be big and strong. And I was like, okay, great, let's do that. I didn't really like, I didn't fundamentally understand the flavor of the Paladin class. I just wanted to be a character who was good at stuff. But now I've figured out like what I do like. I pretty much only play spellcasters these days. Like, I figured out my preferences a lot better. So
that's another thing I would like to just, you know, kind of draw on generally over the course of how we talk about, which is like how you figure out what you're interested in. And broadly, this is just a process of like experience and growing older. But yeah, let's get back to what was that first thing that you published about?
Yeah, so it's a module called Lake of Secrets. I developed it. I took the Write Your First Adventure workshop with the Storytelling Collective before it was called the Storytelling Collective. And so I did the winter session in 2019 to kind of polish it up. because I didn't know necessarily where to put it, or because what I had was I had like a Word document with like bullet point notes for myself on them, and I was like, there is something that like this does not look like a published D&D adventure, but I don't know how to get it to a stage where it does. So I developed that, and it's about a like the aftermath of a war-torn kingdom, and that the sovereign of the country has gone missing, and you know, the party gets hired to find them. And as they go, it's a dungeon crawl, and so like as they go through the dungeon, they can figure out like what exactly happened to this person, and they get to choose like how that resolves. I don't know. I mean, I can talk about. I don't want to be like, oh, spoilers for my own thing. That's kind of obnoxious to say. But essentially, there's a bunch of choices you can make, and you can also go through the dungeon with like completely without combat if you want to.
Okay.
You can also go through and kill everybody on your path, and then you get like the evil ending. Like there's 7 different endings that I figured out for this. Yeah. I wanted it to be flexible, and I wanted it to be playable by everyone, regardless of their inclination or playstyle. So I thought about that, and you know, like there is an ending where, you know, like if you kill everybody in your path, and you can take control of the kingdom for yourself, and you know, like your alignment will change to evil if it wasn't already, like that kind of stuff. Or you know, you can literally go in and decide that, you know, you find out who the bad guys are. You can literally go off and, you know, decide to send them to therapy if you want, and that's like, you know, your good ending. And like, and honestly, people, I didn't expect anybody to choose that ending, but that was the ending that my support group decided to do, and I was like, this is so nice. I'm actually gonna keep this as an official ending. Like, you can send the bad guys to therapy about their issues, and it's great. Yeah.
Looking back, what about that first piece of design is something that you still potentially kind of think about or do even today when you're designing something?
I really like that. I think the whole choices matter situation and giving people options to end the story, and knowing that the options you present are never going to totally encompass the possibilities. Because I think I wrote, like, here are the 7 distinct endings that I can think of. It's possible that your group may go with something else entirely different. Just kind of allow that to happen, basically. So I think I really do like to think of situations that have drastically different outcomes, and for all of the outcomes to still be fun and to allow players to tell a story that they have a lot of fun with.
So you start with this module, and then I assume you publish other things, you play more D&D. At what point do you start getting into games that are not D&D, what I would refer to as like indie games?
Yeah, so that happened probably like the next year. I mean, it's also important to mention that in 2020, when I was kind of starting to do this properly, you know, the pandemic happened. And around the same time that the pandemic happened, the company I was working for, I had a full-time communications job. They laid me off. And so that gave me the gift of free time. Well, I mean, I was unemployed, but it was free time. The gift of free time. So I had a lot more time on my hands. And so I could just start writing things that I want, you know, I was able to start writing things for myself and to kind of mess around with game design. And in 2021, I signed up for the Tabletop Mentorship Program. And that was really good, because I was introduced to a new community called Hutopia. And they primarily are in the streaming space, but there were also a lot of folks in there who were game designers. And so I was able to experience, that was probably my kind of first exposure to indie games, like as in, you know, being developed from the ground up just by, you know, just by people in their spare time, like not even indie as in like published by indie companies. So it was really nice to get to do that. And honestly, like the main draw of streaming for me is that I get to play different games, because it, you know, it's difficult to find time otherwise. But if I have like a commitment that I've agreed to do, and that there are people who are willing to run the game that all I have to do is show up for, then that sounds great. Like, so that was probably where I was introduced to that through that community. And it was really nice. And like the thing about Hutopia is that it's a community for people of color specifically. And so, like, you know, I met and made friends there who have been like, you know, who we're still friends to this day. They've always been there for me. It's been really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Hutopia. That's so cool.
Yeah, definitely.
I think one of the coolest things about streaming is that it's, this wonderful way of like getting four or five people to be extremely engaged about some weird game, like for a few hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's the appeal of streaming to me, is that like it's a lot of work to do a stream. And so, you know, the people who are going to be there really want to be there. And every time I've done it, it's been really fun.
So how did this current kind of job at Hitpoint Press come about? Like, first of all, I mean, what is the role? Could you tell my listeners a little bit about what you do there?
So I am a writer, editor, game designer, of course, but also I've been doing a lot of things on the publishing side of things, because Hitpoint Press does occasionally pick up other people's work and publish it, and it's something that they're looking to do a bit more of. Most recently, I can say that we did a trilogy of Jewish games called If I Were a Lich Man, if you've heard of it. Yeah. So it's three Jewish games by Lucian Kahn. We wanted to do that as like a box set kind of package. So the box set comes with some dreidels. It's a really cool thing. Lucian Kahn had complete creative control over that. You know, he managed his own team of staff. He wanted to work with a Jewish artist and wanted to get a sensitivity consultant, stuff like that. And we helped with the graphic design and packaging, and we managed the crowdfunding campaign for it. And so I did curate an anthology called the Constellation Anthology. And that is an anthology of 12 indie RPGs. And so it's my role with that is helping, like, you know, finding out ways that Hitpoint can help other game designers with their projects.
But I'm guessing that's not what you were kind of hired to do.
Not necessarily, no. I was more hired to be like a game designer.
So was that your DM skill stuff that kind of set you up for that? How did that come about?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I realized I didn't actually answer your question. So that came about because I was looking for freelance opportunities. And one of my friends was friends with someone who worked at Hitpoint. And she was like, do you want me to see if they're willing to take your writing samples? I can inquire about that. And so she did. So she asked for me. And so I got an email address to send some writing samples to. And I was like, hey, you know, I know that you, I can see that you do these, you know, 5e big bad booklets. Here are some writing samples. I'd be interested in writing one if possible. And that actually, like, one of the first things I did when I was at Hitpoint was write a big bad booklet, but I didn't get hired as freelance. I got an email back, like, sometime later being like, actually, are you interested in full-time work? And I'm like, wait, what? Like, yes? Yeah. So that's kind of how that came about.
Nice. So did you get started there sort of like writing on their sort of ongoing projects?
Yes. So at that time, they were developing Fool's Gold, which is an adaptation of Dingo Doodles' YouTube videos about her campaign. So she plays 3.5 with her home table, and Hitpoint was converting that to 5th edition, so as a whole setting. So it's a setting and it's also a campaign.
Yeah.
So I started like kind of in the middle of that. I think my first day I was writing stat blocks for that.
Okay. Now you said you're helping out, or rather like you kind of work on the publishing side of things. So give me a sense of like, you know, what kind of tasks that involves, either for Constellation or If I Were a Lich Man, either one. But like, yeah. What would some tasks on that look like?
Yeah, so I was less involved with Lich Man than I was with Constellation. Constellation, I was given the opportunity to find some games and recommend them to be featured. So part of that was I looked through a lot of the games in my library and itch, because usually when there's like a charity mega bundle and it's offering like, you know, 200 games for like $5 or something, I will pick that up. That's amazing value, and it's for a good cause. And it also just means that I have this absolutely massive library of games accessible to me. Have I downloaded and read each one? No. But do I have them there in case I want them? Yes. So a lot of it was looking through that and seeing what was actually there. And I didn't exactly pick a theme. I just wanted to pick like a variety of different games that let you tell vastly different stories. Like some of them are romance, some of them are horror. They range from like, you know, solo games to multiplayer, GM-less, that kind of thing. So like with that project, it was very much my responsibility to reach out to the creators and let them know if they had to do any layout reworks, because we did want to print them as a hardcover book. And so we would have to adhere to the printer's specifications. And people, like for some of these people, it would be the first time that their games had seen print, which was very exciting. And I did take that into account when making that selection. I did want to give indie designers that opportunity, because printing is its whole thing and not everyone has the resources or the expertise to get their games into print. And so I was coordinating with them to make sure everything was print specific. We had to ask them to take out their page numbers so that we could renumber our pages so that it would correspond to the table of contents and all of that. So, and I did have, I think I did, you know, make sure that everyone signed their contracts and I collected all of the emails for payment and that kind of thing. But in general for publishing, I do review publishing submissions. Like there is a form that you can send into Hitpoint for where you can talk about your project and send it, you know, outline what exactly you're looking for, because publishing, like most people don't really know what publishing is. And I say that not in a judgmental way. I just do think that it's not exactly clear. Like the publishing process is comprised of lots of different parts. And sometimes when people say publishing, they mean they want assistance with bringing their product to market. Some people want assistance with crowdfunding campaigns. And sometimes some people will come to us with like an idea and be like, publish it, as in like you will do all the writing, editing, and art and basically make my product. And, you know, there are various, you know, and each one is like a vastly different task. So it could mean lots of things.
I know all of those experiences well. Nice. So was Constellation something that was pitched to you or you pitched, or like how did that come about? Because that is a really cool project to take existing sort of zines or even shorter games than that and kind of anthologize them.
Yeah, it was something that was pitched to me, like Ricardo Evangelo. He's the owner and the CEO of Hitpoint Press. He originally asked me to do it, and I was really excited to do it, actually, because my background was kind of in indie games before joining Hitpoint Press. So I was kind of doing D&D, and I was kind of also doing indie games, and I was involved in the communities for both. And it was really exciting for me to be a part of it and to have such a role in curating the games. So it was a project that I very much led, but it wasn't necessarily like my idea.
Okay. You said something interesting there, which is that, you know, you're kind of like in both these communities. Can you talk about a little bit, like, you know, what does it mean when you say that you're in the D&D community? Are those two different communities? Do you participate in them differently?
Yeah, I mean, so community is really difficult to define, and it can get a bit spicy if you talk about it as a community. There's lots of people who have very strong opinions about the use of the word community. I should probably just say, you know, space or whatever, but like I say community because like I do have friends in who are game designers for D&D, whether third party or for official material. Like these are people who I've worked with on projects with, and you know, we're in the same kind of orbit, if that makes sense. And the same thing with indie games. I'm sure people will have a lot to say about like dividing it up between D&D and then putting all the indie games in like one category or what have you. But basically, like when I say community, it means that I know people who are doing this also professionally, and I'm aware of like of the events that occur in these spaces. I broadly will keep on top of like the releases from both of these spaces, and like I'm aware of the, I don't want to say discourse, but like I'm aware of the topics of the day. Like I am up to date on news, and I do follow it actively. So it also means that like I'm engaging in these in a kind of hobbyist way as well. So like I am playing indie games, I am playing D&D, I am in, you know, discords and communities in that kind of sense as well.
Yeah. Do you do different kinds of work as a freelancer in both of these spaces? Like, I know you do a lot of editing. Like, are you an editor in one space more than the other? Do you do writing in one space more than the other?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to say. It also becomes difficult when, I mean, I'm doing editing for the Stormlight RPG. Like, could you say that that is indie? You know, that kind of thing. Like, yeah, it's a very big intellectual property, but at the same time, it will be using a custom system. So it depends. I think that, you know, editing for D&D definitely was really helpful and then like that's a kind of transferable skill towards editing other things, because D&D is one of the few games that has a very robust style guide, and it has its mechanics language consistent, and there are certain ways that the game wants its writers and designers to express to express the mechanics and the rules of the game. And that consistency has made me a much better editor, because then I can flag things and I can say, you know, two sentences ago we referred to it as this, like, which one is it? Because it's also made me realize that you have to be very, very clear about how you express your mechanics, because if you encounter a player who is a rules lawyer, how is that going to be interpreted? I do try to make things unambiguous, because I don't necessarily want to be designing for, you know, the worst player who could possibly pick up this game. But at the same time, I do need it to be clear for, you know, comprehension reasons, because if a player has to be like, hey, DM, like, what does this actually mean? Then the DM has to pause, has to, like, you know, maybe pick up another book and look it up, and it stops the flow of play. So essentially, I think that, like, editing in particular, having that background in Dungeons & Dragons first was really helpful. But as to whether or not I do more in one space or the other, I'm not really sure. I think that it's been getting easier for me to get editing work, but I think I'm not sure necessarily why that is, because I think that there are more people who will design and who won't necessarily hire editors. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I assume the reason that you're getting, you know, more calls for being an editor is because you're a very good editor.
I mean, yeah, maybe, but yeah, but I don't know if that answered your question about, no, like, do I do more in one space or the other?
It was a question because I didn't know if there was an answer, you know, that I didn't know if the premise of my question was true or not. It doesn't seem like it. I really like what you were saying about editing kind of being this, like adherence to some kind of style guide. I'm always thinking about games, and I'm always thinking about rules. And the idea that D&D and sort of like these large games that have existed for a very long time have a style guide that is formal and has developed and is sort of like official and kind of like well understood. And when you go into like a new editing project, do you always have to make up a style guide? Do you then like follow that, or are there projects in which there is a kind of like invisible, standardized, unofficial style guide that you're sort of like adhering to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it depends largely on the scale of the project. So editing a game that's going to have, you know, multiple rule books that all do different things, like sometimes developing a style guide is part of my job. Yeah, I'm working right now on the Confluence RPG that'll be published by Publishing Goblin. And so that one has quite a big team, and it's going to be consists of multiple books. And so the editing team was putting together a style guide for that. And my preference is to have one, but if not, I will simply ask, like, what's your preference for this, that, and the other thing? And I do. And another thing I find is that projects without a style guide often will have a preference for certain ways to express the rules. And sometimes I don't even necessarily have to ask for clarification, because the author is consistent, and that's nice. And I think that it is something that people naturally do want to do. And when you point out that there is an inconsistency, you know, the designer will be like, oh, I didn't realize that. I think this is probably a better word choice.
You make a call then and there, and then kind of standardize it across the text, right? Like from there.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And so, like, in those cases, I will end up making myself like a style sheet, which is slightly different from a style guide. It's more of a, like, it's a per project thing that I'll use to track all of the decisions that I'm making as I go along, so that then I don't forget it. So that can cover, like, you know, we use these verbs to refer to these actions in the game. It can be like things like usage, like, I don't know, like this isn't necessarily the most pertinent to tabletop, but I want to talk about, like, the word since. It's like, you know, am I allowed to use that as a way to express, like, causality? So, like, since this happened, now I'm now doing that? Or should it be exclusively, like, an adverb of time? So some people, again, will have very strong opinions on that, too. But, yeah, so, like, that's the sort of thing I put on, like, a style sheet, and that would be more just for myself. If the author is interested, then I can be like, well, I can send you the record of the decisions that I made, and you can use that as a basis for your style guide later if you want. But that just tends to be like my kind of open on like a notes app thing. So
yeah, I've definitely done projects where the style sheet was just the email chain. Like, you know, like every single decision is like added to the, like, everything is copied, and like the last a new item is added and then sent again. So always the latest email just has every decision. But
I mean, it's written down somewhere and at least it's searchable in your inbox. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
But yeah, I have a kind of sort of maybe zoomed out, sort of very open-ended question. What kind of work do you want to do more of in TTRPGs? What are you chasing? Is there some specific thing that you think of as like, yeah, this is the direction I'm moving towards, this is what I want to do more of?
That's a really good question. Like, in terms of like broader goals or just stuff that I'd find fun, like which one?
Maybe both. Maybe start with the smaller one and then we'll get to the big, however you want to define that.
Okay. I think like smaller stuff, I mean, I would really at some point like to sit down and like get back to making like personal projects that I don't necessarily need to sell, or, you know, I'm invested in making a lot of money. But like, I do have like a kind of list of ideas that I've just kind of not touched for a while because I'm very busy. Yeah, like I do have a couple of games like on my itch, but there really aren't a lot of them. And so I would like to make just more kind of fun games. Some of them would be like kind of independent supplements for like existing games. But also there are just like, I have some kind of half-baked thoughts that I'd really like to chase. Like, I want to make like a kind of time travel game that uses D12s just because I think that would be funny, but also just because. And so like in my notes document, it's just like, you know, time travel game, maybe you roll 3D12 and see what happens. And I'm just like, I don't know. I think, is this anything? Like, I would like to do that kind of stuff. I think, like, does that make sense?
12 months in a year. You know, 24 hours in a day. I see it.
Exactly. And so like, I also just, you know, like, yeah, you see the vision. So I just also just base 12 is just supreme, honestly. I think more things should be base 12 because it's easier to half and divide and all of that kind of stuff. Also just the D12, just the D12. Like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, Daggerheart is using the D12 and I'm like, I see what they're doing with that. But also the D12, it's the best die and it's like the least loved. Yeah, so like as you can see, I don't really have much of a structure for this game other than I just think it would be funny to make a time travel game that used a D12 because haha, we measure time in 12. But I think that if I sat down for like a week or so, I could probably make it into something that would make some sort of sense, moderately playable, maybe. So.
And what about really kind of like long-term, I guess?
Long-term, like I mean, I am very happy with the work that I've been doing. And so honestly, I would like to continue to do more of that. I think there are probably a couple of RPGs that I haven't yet worked for that I would like to. Honestly, I'm a big fan of your work on Spire, to be honest, like the Sin supplement, like the Sin book. Honestly, that was really great. The resistance system is really fantastic.
And I saw that you did like an unofficial like little supplement for Heart, which sounded really...
I did, yeah. And like, that was a lot of fun to do. I think I released that one also in 2021. So yeah, I mean, I would like to do more of that, but also like Rowan, Rick and Deckard are like constantly putting out like real cool shit, like constantly. Yeah. And like, honestly, looks really fun. But I'm really happy with doing what I'm doing right now. I feel like I'm getting a good mix of game design, writing, and editing. I wrote for Paizo's Lost Omens Divine Mysteries, which is coming out, and so I didn't do game design for that necessarily because it's like, because that book is about becoming like the definitive like lore guide for the Pathfinder deities. So like, you know, that very much was a writing assignment and that was really cool to do. And right now I'm working on like the Tomb Raider tabletop game. And so I'm not the system designer, but I am a contributing designer. And so like, I'm very happy with what I'm doing with that.
Yeah.
So I just want to keep creating things that are fun, that people like to play with. Like, that's kind of a cop-out answer, but like, I want to make fun stuff, and I want to be able to have enough creative freedom to play with the themes that I like and just, you know, make it a little bit weird. But
no, I mean, it's not a cop-out answer at all, because what you're saying is you're kind of doing exactly what you want to be doing.
Pretty much. I just want to keep doing it. Really. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so cool. I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe before we get into the standard questions that I ask everybody, do you have any advice for folks who were basically you in 2020, you know, just about to start, want to release their first thing or want to get into more freelance design or writing or editing? Yeah, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, definitely. Honestly, like, make like make a thing and make sure that you publish it, make sure that you finish it. Because I understand that it's a hurdle, like making a thing and making and, you know, wanting it to be perfect, but also like perfect is the enemy of done, in my opinion. And done, like done is very powerful in my opinion, because it shows that you can do a thing, commit to it, and finish it. And, you know, it you can and there are a lot of people right now who will do like a kind of Ashcan preview version on Itch and then Itch fund it or crowdfund it and then say, you know, this is what I have right now. I am working to, this isn't its final form. I am developing it. And it's okay to do that. I think that, I don't know, I was, it took me like a year, like over a year to release my the first adventure I talked about. And I don't think it necessarily needed to take me that long. And most of that time, I wasn't even working on it. I was just thinking about it. It was like, it was haunting me. And I was like, oh, like I have to make it perfect. And like, I released it and it's still not perfect. Like I can read it and be like, oh, this is not style guide compliant. What was I doing? But, but I think just, you know, make a thing and make it, you know, start small. And it's okay to start with a small project. I also know that like the allure of, you know, wanting to make like a 300-page book and not wanting to settle for less is a whole big thing as well. But, you know, I think that making a small project and finishing it is very satisfying and you'll learn a lot from doing that. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't make a big project in the future. It just means that maybe that shouldn't be your first one. And I think that like the project that I ended up doing, like my first adventure was like 22 pages or something. And like, I think that the course recommended like a word count of like, I want to say 3,500, like mine was like 13,000 words or something. Like I definitely did not have a good handle on the scope of that. And it took a long time and I was kind of haunted by it. And by the end of it, I was like, you know what? I think at some point I do need to just call this done and release it. So like, My number one piece of advice is to choose a project, make sure its scope doesn't get away from you, and make sure that you release it. That's the most important thing. And honestly, it will feel really satisfying once you've released it. And then once you've released it, you'll want to keep doing it and you'll want to keep making stuff.
And on that note, let's get into my standard questions. My first question, as always, is in a section called Infectious Enthusiasm. I want to know, what's a game that you had a lot of fun with and you want to recommend?
Yeah, so I really loved playing Inkkit. It's by designer Mitzi Tokiero, who is Pukepeku on Itch. So I played it on a live stream once with Utopia, as I mentioned previously, and it was a ton of fun. You play a bloody hunter, which, I mean, I played a vampire because this was part of like the BIPOC vamp jam event. And so it has this really fun mechanic whereby you have a physical beverage to drink from, and you roll a d12, very important because it's my favorite die. And if you roll too low or too high, then you have to drink from your beverage. And if you finish it before a turn ends, then you lose your next turn. And I really like the hydration mechanic because honestly, I have never been so hydrated during a stream. It was great. And I also like the idea that because I was playing a vampire, like I'm constantly thirsty and it's all blood. So I got myself like some water and then put like water flavor in it. It was like strawberry and melon or something. And so it looked red on stream and I was just drinking from a wine glass, like, yeah. So it's a really fun game. Like we all played and we went to hunt. I think we went to hunt landlords because honestly, there are no greater villains really. So yeah.
Nice.
But yeah, highly recommend that.
Okay. In the next section, Tyranny of Numbers, I ask, is there a number or statistic that you can share from your work that you think will be useful or interesting to my listeners?
I think numbers, I mean, I've been doing game design professionally since 2020, as I said, I think, and this is right now my fifth year of doing it. And in terms of numbers, for like the first 3 years, I was making around $4,000 to $5,000 per year. And that, like the majority of that came from either like one or two particularly well-paying or long-term projects, or from being part of like a mega bundle on Itch. And so like if you're an early career game designer, then like that's kind of like what my early career looked like. It's going to look different for everybody, of course. And like, I was still working and freelancing and, you know, I had a couple of other like marketing and copywriting contracts at the same time. People are kind of very hesitant to talk about money. And I think that, you know, more people should talk about money, like yeah, in plain terms. And this is like $4,000 to $5,000 Canadian dollars. So like, you know, your mileage might vary, but.
Thank you. That is such a great answer. I find that talking about money, the best thing about it is that it like just lets people know like, what is a reasonable expectation to have, right? Because without that, you're always like, oh, is this low? Is this high? Am I doing bad? Am I doing good?
Yeah, like, so
it's
nobody
just like,
knows.
Yeah, you just no anchor.
Yeah. Like, it's difficult to, like, benchmark your success. And of course, like, you know, I what I should say is, you know, like, your success should be the gratification of finishing the project. But, like, no, like, people need to eat. Like, we need to get paid. And, like, game designers work. And I think that people should be paid for their labor. But I think, like, the most important part of that is, like, you know, it was because, like, I got lucky on a couple of other projects and, like, or I found something that was more long term. And so if it weren't for, like, those one or two projects, like, it probably would have been, like, I probably would have been making maybe, like, you know, half or less of my final year total for those years. So, you know, I can't say that it's an especially, like, lucrative profession if you're just starting out, but, like, you know, it's not impossible.
Thank you so much for that.
Also, like, the role of luck is also extremely understated. Like, you know, you have to be in the right place at the right time. You have to know people, all of that. And so I think that people are also kind of reluctant to acknowledge that as well. So there is a not insignificant amount of luck involved with these things too. So
there is, like, on one hand, like, these creative professions, these slightly unstructured professions. The problem is that almost everyone has a different path into it. And so, like, it's not super reproducible. But on the other hand, some things remain common, which is that they do work and they have to get lucky. Like, you know, things like that. You know,
yeah,
like, that's kind of
pretty much. Pretty much. Yeah, but, like, what I do like about game design is that the barrier to entry is extremely low. Like, you can't just make an account on Itch and just put up a game. Like, that's and anyone can do that. And that's pretty great, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it is, like, quite amazing to me that in 2020, when I released my first published thing, which was basically some random tables for like a setting, like a sketch of a setting, and someone bought it within the first day, and it was for free. So they bought it and they tipped me some money within the first day, and I was like, looking back, I think if that person had not done that, I might not have made my second thing. But and it's ridiculous, right? Like, but you know, that is the cool thing about this. Like, you know, there might not be a community, but there is something that includes people just looking at stuff that you make and potentially, like, buying it. And, like, yeah, I think that's very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like, yeah. Also, high five to starting in 2020. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Okay. In the section titled Replay, I ask, what's a story or anecdote you've heard about someone else playing one of your games or something else you designed that you'd like to share?
Right. So once in 2021, I was doing, like, a thing called Hype Swap, where you and another game designer exchange games and talk about what you like about them. And so I did that with another game designer. His name is Logan Timmons, and he's Breathing Stories on Itch. And he said that one of my games was his second favorite game ever, and he said that it was stunning and powerful. And honestly, it meant a lot to me to hear that my work had touched someone else that deeply. And that game was Crossroads, which is my map-making game about grief and loss. It's one of my earlier games and, like, you know, one of, like, the two things that I have on Itch. So it was really nice to hear. And honestly, I really love Hype Swap, and I would like to see it come back. It's been a bit difficult, I think, because, like, Twitter's demise and all of that. But, like, the main appeal of it is that you do get to exchange games. That was also a way that I discovered new games to play, because I did endeavor to play them where I could. So I ended up reviewing a lot of solo games for that reason. But that was really, really nice to hear, honestly. And I just, yeah, you know, like, everyone likes getting good feedback on their work.
Yeah.
So
there is no replacement for someone's genuine reaction to something that you do.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Shout out to Logan.
Yes.
In the section, all advice is advice for myself, I ask, what's a habit or technique you're trying to get better at doing while playing games?
Yeah, so at my table, I'm trying to get better at, like, describing rooms and situations out loud. So I do a lot of 5e for my day job, and I run D&D regularly for my home game. And honestly, boxed read aloud text is my nemesis to write and to describe. Like, for some reason, I really struggle to put my mental image of a room, like, into words, because I run my home game online, like, I can kind of find a visual reference, put it on Roll20, and just show it to the players and then just say, like, it looks like this, and then, you know, that's fine. But I also do an actual play podcast called Roads Uncharted that uses the Genesis system. And with that, I don't have that visual option. So I really need to get good at describing things in words. Genesis doesn't necessarily have like a whole, like, you know, this thing has a 30-foot range. It's more like a banded range system. So, like, which helps. So, like, I don't need to know that this thing is 30 feet tall. But, like, to give an example, like, today I sent over like a bunch of notes. So I am the DM for my home D&D game, and one of the players is going to take over and run the next arc for me. And so I had a building, it's a house, and I put, like, you know, for the ceilings, everything is 30 feet high. And she commented being like, this is absolutely insane. Like, you know, that most houses are like, you know, 10 to 12 feet. And I'm like, I don't know what 30 feet looks like. I just picked a D&D number. It comes up a lot. Like, this makes sense. And then she's like, no, your house would be like 90 feet tall. It has 3 floors. Like, come on. And I'm just like, yeah, well, you know what? Just change it to 10 then. That's fine. Like, yeah.
Oh man, yeah. It is a real thing that for a hobby where so much of it happens in rooms, describing rooms is very hard.
It's really hard.
You want to be like, it's a room. You guys have seen a room. It's like that.
Yeah, and like in my opinion, it doesn't really matter too much. It's more like, I want to tell you about the objects on the table that may or may not be cursed. Like, I don't want to talk about that, but like, it doesn't, but like, you know, you need to define like how big the room is and like what the, you know, what the floor is made of. Cause I don't know, like, I might have a player who decides they want to light everything on fire and I need to know whether everything's flammable. So like, I get it. It's useful. Like, it's information that the GM has to have, but also I'm bad at providing that information. So I'm trying to get better at it.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. So thanks so much, Sebastian. Thanks for being here. Is there a link or something that I could put in the description or some kind of social media handle you want to shout out to my listeners?
Yeah. So you can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Sebastian UA. So SebastianYue, all one word. And my website is sebastianua.ca because I'm based in Canada.
Thanks for listening, folks. Next week, we have Sydney Icarus. Sydney is the designer of games like Decaying Orbit, also the former host of a really cool podcast called The Hard Move. We're going to be talking about all sorts of stuff. Tune in next time. Till then, does Indie need you? Yes, indeed.
And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonian, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.